You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestall. When we hear the word cult, our minds conjure up an image of gullible people blindly following a series of fake prophets, leaders who can offer salvation, even the real truth. If anything, these preconceived ideas couldn't be further from the truth, and joining me to unpack some other misconceptions is author J.W. Ucker. We'll touch on Jim Jones, David Koresh, Marshall Applewhite and others as we try to unpick why do people fall into cults. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. And you can click the link in the show notes as usual. Thank you to my latest patrons, Abby, Lisa, and Rianne. And thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support the show. Mysteries and Monsters is across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. The Mysteries and Monsters merchandise site is available exclusively through TeePublic, and the link for that is in the show notes as always. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you to Dean Bessel for his wonderful artwork, and the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. Let us now consider the elasticity of belief and the need to belong with Jay. There is a perception that none of us are gullible enough to end up as a member of a cult, yet the evidence suggests intelligence is no protection from the persuasion of a charismatic leader or certain circumstances that leave us feeling so vulnerable. In his latest book, author J.W. Ucker peels the curtain to reveal some jaw-dropping, eye-opening, and in certain situations, terrifying cult organizations. J.W. Ucker, welcome back! It's been so long. I'm lovely to finally speak to you again, my friend.
No, thank you for the invite. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to this for sure.
Oh, as we were joshing before we started, this is a very intriguing subject on a variety of levels. And I feel like I've gone through some kind of transformation in the last 30 years, I think, because cults were not something, especially here in the UK, we've got a few sort of out there ones that kind of dance around the fringes of ufology more than anything. But anything that's sort of quasi-religious or new age hasn't seemed to have really taken off to the extent they have in other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's one of those, I can kind of place my life against certain things. The Branch Davidians is probably a prime example of this, because I remember I was living on my own as a very young man, and we had cable news all the time. And so on an afternoon, we'd lock the pub up and we'd turn the TV on. And sometimes you just get the news on because you just thought, well, do I want to watch MTV all day again? Those kind of things you do in your early 20s, Jay. Yeah. And obviously at that time, it was during the siege at Waco. And so I kind of saw it all happen, because I think that's one of the first instances we'd had of sort of live 24-hour rolling news reporting on an event such as this. And ironically, later that decade, I remember watching an episode of Sightings, which focused on this whole kind of conspiracy regarding what happened and the FBI and David Koresh and what was going on. And it introduced me to a gentleman who's become one of the most well-known conspiracy theorists in the world, Alex Jones.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because he, for some reason, took the Branch Davidian case to his heart. It became like a cause célèbre for him. And I remember him going on some kind of march, leading the rest of the Branch Davidians to try and get justice. Mm-hmm. And so it shows you that even when we're talking about organizations such as that, who collapsed so visually in front of the world, you still had people that were coming round to it 2, 3, 4, 5 years later because of these weird intricacies in them.
Yeah, and it's that was a big one. I remember, same as me, I remember seeing that on the news. And it was funny, though, because the focus in my mind, I could be remembering this wrong, right? The focus wasn't really on, oh, look, that's a cult. And like, what's a cult? And what do they believe? And especially in the States, we're watching this thing. Wait, those are our government's tanks running over a building. Those are our government's guns. Like, those are citizens being fired on by the authorities, local, federal, and state. And that was a scary moment. We're like, man, again, the Koreshans have massive, they at the time had massive amounts of problems. David Koresh was no saint, all those things. But we couldn't even focus on what the details of the cult because we were just so terrified by watching, you know, again, federal tanks crashing over walls and, you know, explosions going on. And we're just going like, wait, the government, you know, the government can do this. And of course, that went on to inspire, like, you know, Timothy McVeigh to do the more stuff. And like, you know, it was a wake up call, not a wake up call, but it definitely grabbed all of us in a different way. And of course, some people were, you know, grabbed them in the wrong way. But yeah, it was a huge moment. It was a huge moment where, again, you were talking about cults, but again, we were still terrified of like these tanks. that was the thing. But again, so today you should bring up that topic and you go deep into it. It's layers and layers. And it's no surprise that conspiracy theories love to get in there. But at the end of the day, they were still a cult. They were still did had some very bad practices. They were still abusive. A lot of the deaths were directly from them. So it is a very complicated case. But if you're just talking about a cult, they fit every kind of lineup of cult there is that's out there. But yeah, you're right. That brought this to like the fore where we were actually seeing the end of a cult, right? I mean, the Branch Davidians are still around today, but they're a much different organization. But we were seeing the end that we, in our minds, all cults end up in some kind of, you know, calamity, catastrophe, death, all those kinds of things.
Yeah. I mean, like you say there, there are so many layers to this because you would presume that anybody who considered themselves to be normal would be watching this and, like you say, would be wondering what on earth has caused a situation where the officials are sending tanks into a farmhouse in the middle of Texas, for God's sake.
Right.
You know, what on earth have they got in there? People would, you know, be wondering about. And so I suppose that it's one of those things that I think authorities don't realize that even the way that they treat such organizations can be radicalizing for other people.
Yes.
Because it buys into that they're after us, they're out to get us. Everything I've told you about the outside world is right. Look outside, look what they're trying to do to us. And it just reemphasizes their power.
Yeah, and they're not totally wrong, right? Because the use of force, and again, you guys do it better over in England. Like, you don't, like, our cops look like they're straight out of the military, right? They have like flak jackets and 1,000 guns. It's really not great. If you look at like the case of Father Piotr's cult in Russia, right? Mm. This was a group that hid underground. They it was like, I can't remember, like 30 of them. It was an apocalyptic cult. They wouldn't, you know, buy food with barcodes on them, and the end times are coming. And he sent them all into this cave underground, a hole, really, not really a cave, a hole they dug out. And the Russian authorities came by and said, you know what? Nobody's getting hurt. We're just going to sit here and ask them to come out until they come out. And that's all they did. And it wasn't a giant firefight. Nobody, two people died, but they died of natural causes in the cave of just like heart attacks is what happened to them. But there was no, because the Russian authorities didn't use a show of force and just like, listen, nobody's hurting anybody. They're just in this hole. We'll just try to get them we'll just sensibly let them stay there and come out peaceably. And that worked versus, you know, throwing tanks and gas even though the Koreshans were well-armed, they were stockpiling weapons. That was one of the things. Mm. Still they weren't doing anything that moment that needed tanks and every single law enforcement agency on the planet there. And that kind of response is valid. It's a valid criticism of the response. Doesn't excuse the cult. It doesn't excuse what Father Piotr's team was doing. It doesn't excuse what Koresh's group was doing.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's such an interesting comparison to see, like, it rationally, you know, it rationally taken care of and then us just throwing bullets and rounds at it.
Well, I think it's a prime example of how quickly things can get out of hand and escalate. Because essentially, if everybody pulls a gun out, there's only going to be one solution here. Something's bad's going to happen.
It's Chekhov's gun in real life, right? If somebody walks in with a gun on their hip, I mean, there's a chance that's going to get pulled out at some point, and then that there's no de-escalation if there are guns on hips. This is just not going to happen, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So and again, you guys kind of learned that way before we have learned that or whatever. So
I suppose as well, when you were sort of drafting this book and looking at it, did you have a selection of organizations you wanted to look into? Because the one thing I'm still surprised at, Jay, when I indulge myself and watch documentaries about cults and the members and whistleblowers and things like that, is I'm still surprised that there are cults that pop up who seem to be quite well established in their era, because a lot of them are very transient. They seem to last for a certain amount of time and then it just implodes. I'm still amazed that I stumble across them and I think, what on earth is, where have these guys been? I mean, the one that springs to mind recently, and I can't remember the name of the organization, but it ended up being fronted by a gentleman whose name just makes me chuckle because he sounds like a cabaret singer, Tony Alamo.
That's good.
Which made me chuckle as well because of my love of cryptids. He had a compound in Falk, Arkansas, which is also the home of the beast of Boggy Creek.
Yeah, I've been there.
And so I know people that have been there. Nobody's ever mentioned the fact that there was a cult hiding out there, which is one of those that just shows all those kinds of aspects of it, that you have a couple who sort of bring this kind of new Christianity to people. It attracts people. They feel like they're finding the truth. They end up becoming essentially a slave workforce for the two individuals that run these organizations. The woman passes away and the guy who remains just seems to go absolutely bananas. Because even though their behavior up to the death, and I've forgotten the lady's name who was sort of the co-head of this organization that Alamo eventually took over, it really seems that he put his foot to the pedal. As soon as she passed on, it just became some kind of weird sex cult with members giving him their children. And then just this disturbing level, once again, a disturbing escalation of belief systems that just... Even with everything I've read and everything I know about some of these organizations, even I had to take a sharp intake of breath, Jack, because I just couldn't believe what I was eating, especially as he's only got sent to prison in the last 10 years.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, in general, in my experience researching these cults, if the cult leader is male, it is inevitably going to be a sex cult in some form or fashion. Mm. If the cult leader is female, they won't do that. But for some reason, well, not for reasons I think are probably pretty transparent, that's where, you know, male leaders take their cults every single time. It's just some kind of weird, even David Koresh, we mentioned him already. He made a rule that was like, hey, I get all your wives, all men stay celibate except for me, because I'm fathering some new tribe of people. It just, it's another form of power, right? That's one of the problems with cults, is that power check. And I think the reason what you're seeing there, again, when I did start this book, I think I saw a stat. I can't remember what it was now, but literally the number of cults are in the tens of thousands. Mm. I had 60 that I started out with that I thought were interesting. Then I boiled that down to 30 for the book. The way I personally define cults is an unsuccessful religion or a religion that will be unsuccessful if it isn't yet. Mm. Because really, the line between a religion and a cult is almost non-existent. It's really size-wise, right? Religions are too big to fail. Cults aren't, right? So if there is a controversy, right? Nexium, right? There's a sex slave controversy. We send him to jail and like it kind of falls apart a little bit. When the Catholic Church has a sex controversy, they're big enough that they can kind of isolate that corruption, ideally, and move it out and say, this isn't us. This is just something that went wrong in us. So they're again, like it's like that phrase for banks, too big to fail.
Yes.
A religion has arrived at a point where it's too big to fail. Because at some point, every religion was a smaller group saying weird things. At the end of the day is what religion is.
Yeah.
And then, you know, over time, it just got big enough that it can weather the controversies, and other groups, what we conventionally think of as cults, don't weather those controversies. Sometimes those controversies are mass suicide, like Heaven's Gate, or they are financial embezzlement financial embezzlement problems, or sex issues. But they just can't weather that because all the power is under one person, and when that falls, the rest of it falls. And there's not enough of a foundation for them to just kind of grow and evolve into a large organization. Some organizations I would call, that some people call cults, that I almost would call religion these days, Scientology. Like, they have weathered so many controversies, not just the recent ones where celebrity whistleblowers are coming out and saying these guys are awful.
Yeah.
I mean, when they first started, when they first made Land, they were originally a water-based cult. When they made Land in Clearwater, Florida, and they took over the hotel there, they actually got raided by the FBI because they had plans in place to take over Clearwater. And the FBI raided them, and they survived that. And they eventually actually did end up taking over Clearwater. They just did it legally by, like, buying property everywhere. Yeah. So that's why they always pop. I think it's just a very human thing for us. It's almost like evolution, right? There's always kind of traits and things being picked up and dropped at all times as species grow or die out.
Yeah.
That's why these cults keep popping up, is because it's just this kind of evolution of religion, hoping to achieve this like state like a shark, where they're a yes. perfect organism that's around for forever, like the Catholic Church has been, right? Like other religions have been. So yes. I think that's why there's, and again, this was kind of a departure for me because, you know, I wrote a book about cryptids and I pretty much know most cryptid stories, right? All the classic ones. There's new ones all the time, but there's very few that are like big stories anymore.
Yeah.
With cults, though, I can get stumped. There's so many new cults, I get stumped regularly when I do interviews or like talks and people say, have you heard about this cult? I'm like, no, I know I spent 2 years researching cults, but no, I have not heard about that cult because there's just so many of them. It's a part of existing, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting you bring up some of these religious organizations that can seem to just, it's almost like they're Teflon coated, Jay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The current Archbishop of Canterbury here in the UK has had to resign over a sex scandal that he's assisted covering up for 30 years. So right. At the moment, the Church of England does not have an Archbishop of Canterbury.
But what they have, though, is a structure
yes.
that can exist without the Archbishop, right? Or yeah. they can replace the Archbishop. So,
yes.
And that's what they need. Cults usually don't have that structure where, again, even if they're a nice cult, and there are some cults that aren't abusive. Mm. If the leader dies, the cult goes away because they don't have that structure set up for longevity or whatever. Or the leader doesn't set it up because he doesn't really care about longevity. He yeah. just cares about being in control or power, and that's all he cares about.
Mm. I suppose the one that I find myself going back to over and over again, and I think this is probably the best example of things going horrendously and horribly wrong, which is Jim Jones.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm amazed, Jay, how many times I keep going back to this, even though it's quite a well-established timeline. As we've touched on, I understand exactly why he became so popular when he did, because mm-hmm. it's the end of the 60s. He's in California. He's kind of preaching this connection with the Age of Aquarius that's going on, mm-hmm. the free love movement, but he's also working in civil rights. He's yep. an open church. His congregation is probably the most mixed in America mm-hmm. at that particular time.
Yep.
He's bringing people together as a religious leader should do.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, pulling on these people coming from very different backgrounds, the one thing that all seems to connect them is they all want to be better. They all want the world to be better.
Mm-hmm.
And what Jones is saying in those early sort of firebrand sermons that he gave in the late 60s, clearly there's a lot of what he says that you can't really disagree with. And
that's
I think
right.
this is what people overlook. They all, as we've touched on, some of them come out with some very outlandish ideas. But I think for a lot of them, the hook that gets people in is it's all about equality, human rights, working together. We're the future. This is mm-hmm. what the world should be like.
Yep.
And then when you've got everybody in, that's when it all starts to go sideways. And Jones is a prime example because it just seems to go from 0 to 60 in such a quick space of time, ending up in the horrific events that took place in Guyana. And so every time there's a new documentary or they've got people, relatives and some of the survivors, how anybody got out of Jonestown, I still find incredible, Jay, with what went on. I just find it just enthralling because when you hear these people talking about what they went through, you can see them. They go through that. Everything was great. Everything was great. It started getting a bit weird. The state's after us. We go to Guyana, everything turns to shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sometimes it happens without people knowing, right? Because we're talking about organizations, and Jim Jones's church was pretty large, right?
Mm-hmm.
So stuff can be happening at the top level that you have no idea about, right? And again, these people are believing in a leader for sure. We all do, right? Whether it's a boss or a president or whatever, whoever it is, we all like follow leaders. But these people also kind of the message resonates, right? So it's no mystery why people join cults to me. Like, and again, these aren't cults. They would never call them cults, right? They never say I'm joining a cult. Nobody ever says that, right? No, that phrase has not been uttered in the history of the world, right? I am joining a cult. What I always tell people, like when they ask the question, and you brought it up in the intro, I'm glad you did, is, you know, could I ever be tricked into joining? Am I gullible enough? Am I not intelligent enough? Right? Those are the questions you usually get asked around cults. And I always tell people, those are the wrong questions. Those are not the right questions. What you should ask yourself is at your lowest point in your life, will you accept help? Like if the answer to that's yes, then you could join a cult, right?
Yeah.
Because again, and then that trauma, that situation you're in might be physical, might be health-wise. It might just be existential, right? This guy, I don't know what to believe in this world anymore. And this guy's doctrine sounds pretty pleasing or pretty much right on, I'm gonna hook onto that, because again, I need help. I need someone to help me. And again, the metaphor I use in the book is, if you're drowning and somebody reaches out their hand, you don't ask whose hand it is. You just grab it desperately. Mm-hmm. They pull you into the boat, and all you care about at that point is you just have massive relief that you're not drowning. You don't care who did it. It could have been the worst person on the planet. Don't care. You're not drowning anymore. And then you're just happy to exist on this boat. You don't care where it's going, who's piloting it, what the plans are, what they're preaching. You're just happy to be on this boat. And then one day, maybe you're not anymore. Maybe you start looking around, you start seeing things. But at that point, the boat has gone so far, your only choices are to jump out of the boat, back into that drowning world, or just see where it goes, right? Trust in the group, which we do all the time. We trust in the group, right? Some people are in cults or stay in cults because they have friends there, because they have family there, right? So it just, to me, it makes so much sense. And it's just the way we run life. We join things. We always join things. We're human beings. We're a social species. We join things. And even if they have really weird doctrine, really weird, again, the UFO cults always have really weird doctrine. It doesn't matter. Like, again, the established churches and organizations have really weird doctrines. If you break down like Christ and all the things that people believe about Christ, it's super weird. We're just used to it. So even that doesn't really turn me off, that people will buy, you know, Heaven Gates comment or the weirder stuff that's in this book. One of them is breatharianism, the belief that we can live without eating. Is, again, and I used to be a Christian. So I used to be, and one of the reasons I wrote the book, I wanted to write the book, is I spent probably 25, 28 years of my life firmly believing some pretty extravagant things. And now I don't believe them. So like what that tells me, unless I'm super unique on the planet, is that we all have the capacity, that belief is super elastic. Like we can believe anything and then not believe it. Like that means that, you know, our ability to believe just has no bounds. It's part of what we are, who we are. So it has nothing to do with intelligence, has nothing to do with gullibility. It just has to do with humanity, which is good news in some ways, because then we're not like being elitist, but also it's bad news, because what it means is if joining a cult is a very human thing to do, and cults almost inevitably end in abuse and ruin and death and destruction, that means abuse, ruin, death, and destruction is also very human. And that's super terrifying to me. I don't like it, but I can't escape that ending.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it's one of those. You can see that happening at the end of Jonestown, because obviously the catalyst for this event is when the senator turns up.
Yep, that's right.
And he's got this performance. You know, he's got everybody singing, and they all have this food that they've created, and these wonderful fields that they're all working to build this heaven for them going forwards, and this is how it's all going to be. And then people start passing these people notes saying, help me, get me out of here. Yep. I need to go. That, you can see that by that point, people are thinking he's lost it. Because I think this is one of the other aspects, I think, of this one particularly, is we've got these audio clips, and we've also got footage of what happened with the senator. I mean, it's still 30, 40 years on, I still find it chilling, Jay, whenever I see it, because it's never good when you see anybody lose their life. But in those circumstances, especially being a senator, for God's sake, that somebody would have, I wouldn't say it's audacity, but someone has completely lost their grip on reality, I think, at that point, that they think that is an acceptable solution to a problem of his congregation realizing he's out of control.
Yeah, and that proves the power part of cult leaders, where he would rather take that cult down with him than just leave and just end the cult. In that case, is just dissolve it. Okay, everybody run, go home. He has to take them all. They all have to die. Because again, it's this all or nothing, black and white. These people are mine. Like if I can't have them, nobody can. Right. That's literally that idea. That idea you always see with like lover crimes.
Yeah.
If I can't have them, nobody can. And, you know, it ends that way. And again, that one's also a really complicated one, right? Because we know it wasn't the popular cultural perception of that is just a lot of, like, again, very, very vulnerable, very gullible people all taking suicide out of a punch. That's not the way it was. It was a lot of murders were happening. A lot of these people were elderly or children and couldn't actually have committed suicide by themselves. So it was much more, I'm going to say normal. It's much more normal than just a bunch of people be typically just quaffing some paper cups. It was a massacre at the end of time. It was the Jonestown massacre. So again, it's so appalling. And then once you start breaking down, it does start making sense. And that it becomes even more appalling. Once it starts making sense, you're like, oh, okay, now I kind of understand. Oh my gosh, this is awful. Yeah. Like, so there's no layer where you're okay with it. Yeah. Put it that way, of understanding. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think this is one of the things that often gets pasted onto cults as well, Jay, as you say there. There is this perception that everybody at Jonestown willingly, and this is the other thing, everybody drank the Kool-Aid, and I'll quantify that statement in a second, because the evidence shows that, as you say, there were elderly people there, there were children there, there were women, men who were shot, beaten to death, force-fed the drink, but the term Kool-Aid has become synonymous with cults now. And this is the thing that's always annoyed me. Like you, I suspect I'm a bit of a pedant about things, because they didn't drink Kool-Aid. It was bloody Flavor-Aid.
It was. And we have photos, like, again, of empty Flavor-Aid packets all over the floor of Guyana. And, but for me, though, I have a history in marketing, and I find it fascinating because Flavor-Aid dodged a giant bullet. Like, Kool-Aid has their brand now. And over time, of course, don't drink the Kool-Aid has become gentled into less of a cult thing and more like, you know, corporate or news or anything like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the moment, Kool-Aid got this massive brand hit that should have gone to Flavor-Aid. And I'm sure the Flavor-Aid, the corporate execs of Flavor-Aid are just kind of wiping their brow. So like they dodged a massive bullet. But again, Kool-Aid was too big to fail. They didn't go down because they were involved in the cult. But yeah. That's exactly right. It should be that phrase that's in culture, even this day, decades later, should be don't drink the Flavor-Aid. Yes. But it's just not. And it never will be.
Yeah. And I mean, it just shows you how these ideas and perceptions get cemented into popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's there. It doesn't matter what you or I say. We're not going to be able to stop people using that term now, because it's synonymous with people in a cult, like you say, or people that aren't sort of don't seem to have a grip on reality, or they're being told. Yeah, messages that are sending them doolally.
Like, I've always wanted to interview corporate execs at Kool-Aid, whoever owns them now. I'm sure they're owned by 17 layers of mega corporations, and be like, you're the only brand on the planet where the cliche is don't do that. Don't consume you. Like, nobody, no food product wants that. Like, don't eat the Krispy Kreme donuts. No. Like, what? It's the exact opposite of what you want out of this entire company.
Yeah.
So I'm sure I would love to know if there were like corporate memos around this or like damage control. I just maybe it's out there on the internet. I haven't just had the chance to like look it up, but that to me, that's the fascinating part. I immediately just tangent right in that part of the story. Maybe it's also a defensive mechanism because, you know, you go from that carpet of bodies and you're just appalled and you're like, oh, I'm going to go research Flavor-Aid for a little bit and take a break.
Yeah, I certainly didn't appreciate it when I used to see their adverts on the back of Marvel Comics in the 80s, Jay.
That's right. You immediately think of Jonestown. You just immediately think of Jonestown. Like, I don't know. But they're still around. It's hard to like, they're too big to fail too.
I mean, like I say, it's not a morbid fascination I have with this. I find it so challenging for me on several levels. This is why I find this topic fascinating, because I don't understand why Jonestown keeps pulling me back in, like I said, because I just can't stop. When something new comes out about it, I have to watch it. I have to hear these people share their terrible, terrible experiences. I think because I am a naturally empathic person, I care, and I'm genuinely interested in hearing how these people have moved on with their lives, I think, as well, because for a lot of the people who survived and got away, they lost friends, family, children, people they'd known all their time in that particular organization. Regardless of what happened, they've got to carry that with them forever. And I would imagine a lot of people in that particular situation suffer from what we call survivor's guilt.
Yeah, and that's a very important nuance, because, again, the survivors aren't saying, I miss the People's Temple. They say, I miss my family. I miss my friends. I miss the people in the People's Temple, right? And that's a massive, important part of it, to say, you know, these were good people. These were real people. And again, you can look at me as a cult member survivor, but, you know, I was there for my friends. I was there for my, you know, it wasn't all just sycophantic looking at Jim Jones. It was a literal community. So again, it takes that word cult and breaks it down into human terms. And that's why they had the Survivors Guild, right? It's not that they survived a cult, even though that's the big headline, right? That's the big, big eye-grabbing headline. It's I lived and my family died, or I lived and my friends died. And that's the actual story. That's like, you know, why they carry that for the rest of their life. They're not, you know, it's no shame in being in a cult. It's just shame that they lost, you know, they just feel bad. They feel awful that they lost their loved ones.
Yeah. And as you say, it plays on that dynamic, because there would have been people there who were reticent about what was going on, who thought this was bad, but probably had someone who was vulnerable that they cared about there, and therefore they stayed to look after them.
Yeah. And it's one of those situations, it's impossible to judge unless you were there, right? Yeah. It's just such an extreme, but again, it's an extreme human situation. Again, the path toward it was pretty normal, but the actual situation itself of in Guyana was very extreme. You can't be like, I would not have done that. I would not have drank the Kool-Aid. I would not have I'd have been the one to stand up and say, this is wrong, right? Right. Which no, you know, you just don't know. You do not know. And in fact, everybody that survived was basically in a different place. Like the capital city had a bunch of people stumbled running the organization up there. So they were nowhere near what happened. It's the word cult is very, it puts a bubble around things that really, and in fact, most academic research these days are not using cult anymore. They're trying to use emerging religion or new religion or something like that, because it there's so much baggage around cult, and immediately makes it others them, right? It others the people in the cult. Yeah. I still love it. To me, it's much more descriptive than emerging religion, and much more, you're communicating more things with the word cult, but still it others them a little bit, because, you know, they're in this thing that you're not, although you're probably in something, you know, not as damaging, but we're all involved in something for sure.
Absolutely. I think this is the thing. I think sometimes you can go at this particular subject with broad strokes and you miss all the intricacies of it. Like we say, you've got the human dynamic, you've got the situations, you've got personal circumstances, you've got inter-community relations.
Which is why most accounts focus really on the leader, because the leaders have the interesting story. The followers, if you tell their story, they're pretty sensible. They're like not, they're not weird. There's no mystery to it. You're like, okay, yeah, they did that. That makes sense. I would probably do the same thing in their shoes. So that's why most stories focus on the leaders. The leaders usually have the weird story, the question marks on why they do this and why would they think this is good and like what happened to them. And that, so in this book, I try to get away from that, but it was almost impossible to get away from that because the leaders have the story, the weird story.
Hmm. I mean, I suppose as well, one of the most striking aspects of Jonestown is the lady, as you say, who was in the capital city in Guyana on the recruitment trail.
Yep.
Survived, returned home, and then fell into the arms of another cult leader.
Yep. Sinanon.
Who was doing similar yet slightly different things.
Mm-hmm.
And you sometimes wonder if you end up in a situation like that once and somehow manage to escape by just good luck more than anything, to then find yourself falling into it again, it kind of obviously there's a perception there that this particular person must have felt lost, needed to belong. And as we were talking about survivor's guilt, you would also have those people that I imagine, Jay, they can't function without this framework of a belief system around them. Yeah. But they've lost interest in traditional religion.
That's a good example. So the woman that was in two cults, and she survived Sinanon as well and went on to write a lot about her experiences. So what I appreciate about her story, though, is so Jonestown was a Christian sect. It was a Christian cult, very Christian tenets in it, right? Mm. It's not like she ran from one church to the next church. Sinanon was like it started out as a Narcotics Anonymous group. It was like it wasn't self-help. It was like helping people who had addiction problems. In her case, you know, grief, and at that point in time, they'd widened to be, you know, grief and depression was something they also helped with. So it wasn't like she ran from the arms of one God to the next God. It was she left the church and she joined a helpful organization, what should have been a helpful organization that again turned out to be a cult. And so you can't blame her. It's just natural to join a group. It's just so natural. And again, most people the U.S. is secularizing a lot. All the surveys that come out, we're becoming more of a secular society. But everybody who's in a church is in some kind of group with beliefs, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody who's a fan of a sports team is to the point that we're using like fandom has almost become a cult, right?
Yeah.
Of like movies and the different kinds of things. We are joiners. That's literally what we do. We join. And just because you didn't join Jonestown, doesn't mean you wouldn't have, or you didn't join something similar. You can't join something. Again, the question is, at your lowest, are you going to accept help from a group? You know, and yes, we all will. You know, it's just some of those groups turn out to be have abusive leaders at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. I suppose with my interest in the Fortean subject, Jay, I've probably come across this more than most people who have an interest in, say, cryptids or whatever, because whilst certain Bigfoot believer groups can be sort of quasi-cult-like, and, you know, if I see another photo with a red circle on, I might pop my eyes out with an egg spoon, I think, showing me a blurry picture of a tree. And you can't talk to these people at all. They see faces everywhere, and they, you know, they'll not say that they are, but for me that's mm-hmm. the kind of cult behavior, because they're just not rationalizing information in the way that we would. And so the Seekers organization is one I'm quite aware of, primarily because of what happened. Is one of those moments where you think, why on earth did anybody carry on with this? But it also gave us a whole breakthrough in the world of psychology, because we then developed the term cognitive dissonance, where something goes wrong, you've been told this is going to happen, it doesn't happen, you're given a reason for it, and you go, oh well, fair enough, and you just mm-hmm. carry on, and you're like, hang on, what? No.
Yes, as human beings, we can hold two ideas in our head that are opposite. In the case, so back in the Seekers, they were a UFO cult, very small UFO cult in Chicago. They predicted it in times. Most cults that are going to end badly will call out a date, because that urgency helps them recruit. They call it a date when the UFOs are going to come pick them up. Word got out in the papers. A research group in Minnesota said, oh, this is our chance to see what happens the day after the prophecy doesn't come true.
Yeah.
So they actually joined this group of researchers, joined the cult, and kind of bolstered it a little bit, because it was a small cult. So just by joining it, they bolstered it and studied it, saw the buildup, the December when the UFO didn't arrive. They saw what happened afterwards, and they were able to realize, oh, you know, this isn't a intellect thing. And belief is never an intellect thing, almost never an intellect thing. So that when the UFOs didn't come, the group didn't like start fighting and dissolve and like call each other liars. No, they just rationalized an idea and continued, right? So, and that again, that phrase cognitive dissonance came out of that, which is a massively helpful phrase in all walks of life, not just cults, but like everything. And we're able to do that. We're doing that today, right? You get into a car, you tell yourself, this is a very dangerous situation to be driving 70 miles an hour on a highway surrounded by other strangers driving 70 miles an hour, but I won't die. Yeah. Right. We have to hold the risk and we hold them both in there, or I can't lose weight, but you know, I keep eating too many calories. Like we can do both those things in our head. And those are like benign ones, but like we can do anything, right? It's just, I think it comes down to belief is not an, we think belief is intellectual, right? We want to pretend that our beliefs are tried and true and tested and fact checked and all these things, but really we believe because we believe, right? And those people you're talking about that circle the blurry images of a tree stump that looks like a Bigfoot, they're not looking for evidence to weigh and create an idea and dismiss an idea. They just want to believe very strongly, like the rest of us do. Whatever it is we believe in, we want to believe it strongly. And that's why. So when you know, predictions fail, when like leaders die, when they proclaim immortality, or when people die in a cult that are supposed to be immortal, you know, we just rationalize our way. And we do all this time. I mean, again, we just had like a very, very tumultuous election here in the States. You saw people rationalizing left and right and what they said before and afterwards and stuff like that. And it just, because again, you know, nobody changed their opinions when a big moment happened. They just all believe that moment backed up their opinions, right? Or they changed their opinions slightly or their story slightly so they could live with it. It's just, again, it's the way humans work, which makes it normal, but also makes it scary, because the way we work is not very good. We're not very good organisms, other than somehow taking over planets. We're good at that, but we're not good, you know, we're not well made internally, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, the Seekers always makes me chuckle, because like you say, they got this end times, this lady who was doing this automatic writing from these aliens who only she could communicate with.
Yep.
They were going to come, they were going to blow us up, we weren't being very nice, but thanks to her organization and the I wouldn't say they were prayers. I think they were meditating a lot, weren't they, about peace?
Yep.
And so they all went outside at 4 a.m. or whatever it was supposed to be that the spaceships were going to come and obliterate us all. and they didn't turn up. She went, well, then we've obviously meditated enough. Oh, hang on, I've got a message.
Yep.
They've told me you've saved the Earth, everybody. Well done. And they all went, right, great.
Yeah, and later on, her second in command, he said, no, they came. We saw them. There was one out in the crowd. You just didn't see them. So, like, I don't think they were lying. I think they truly believe that. Again, the line between a leader who is manipulative and a leader who drinks his own punch, it's a very blurry line. You can't tell which is which. Mm-hmm. But at some point, you have, when you're that wrong, that publicly wrong, you kind of have to, again, the cognitive dissonance kicks in. You have to somehow explain that in a way that you weren't wrong. Like, you can't just be like, yeah, I guess I was wrong. Let's dissolve the cult. I'm wrong. Sorry. I'm not Jesus Christ. There's no UFOs. That never happens.
Yeah.
So there's a reason that never happens. It's because it's not a very human thing to do. The human thing to do is rationalize and keep going and figure out a way why this is true, right? And again, this happens in the microcosm. Like, the person who serial dates all the wrong kind of partners, right? Constantly going to the wrong partner. They know it, but they also rationalize, this is a different partner. This partner's not abusive, or this partner is not this way. Nope.
Yeah.
Again, that's why we all are in patterns. We're all in cycles that we're trying to break because we're so good at cognitive dissonance.
Yeah. And very, very much so. I suppose as well, it kind of leads me into another UFO tinge cult, probably the most notorious one. And as I said before we started, Jay, this is one I remember reading about because I just started reading the Fortean Times regularly. We started getting cable shows over here, so we had a bit more American television coming over, so we probably got more sort of pop culture coverage of it than we would have done here in the UK generally, because things like that just don't tend to sort of hit the zeitgeist here unless it's a major one such as Jonestown or Waco.
You know why? I'll tell you exactly why. This is Heaven's Gate you're talking about. This was kind of the first cult on the internet. So when we heard about this weird death and people in like tennis Nikes and laying in bunk beds and dead, literally you could go on your computer, type in their website and read about them from their own mouth. They had videos of why they were doing it. They had entire credos. You could literally by yourself research Heaven's Gate and learn everything about them in this new thing called the internet, right? This was the late 90s when this happened. Yeah. And that's why it was weird, right? Weird helps sell headlines, but we all had this like personal piece where we could literally go touch the cult ourselves with their website. And that's why I think it got shoved so strongly into the zeitgeist, is because the internet, you know, we could just go right to their website, to whatever, heavensgate.com or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Which I think it actually is still up.
It is. I have to say, every 6 months or so, Jay, I check it's still there, and it is. I know. And it still looks like a website from 1997.
Yes, and all its glories. They actually, one of the ways they funded the organization is they built websites for people.
Yes.
They were like designers and coders, you know, so that's, again, very modern thing.
It is. And it shows you sometimes the intelligence behind the people behind it, because not many people would have thought mid-90s as an income stream would be to create and build websites for businesses. They were very much ahead of the curve, yeah. You know, regardless of everything else that was going on. That's a very unique strand to them, to be that sort of enmeshed in futuristic technology. You know, you would speak to an average person 30 years ago and try talking to them about the internet, and you may as well be speaking Latin to them, Jay. They had no idea what you were doing. Or you know, I don't know exactly the first time I went online, but it's around the period when Heaven's Gate finished in that cataclysmic day of decision making. And so people were getting their sort of brief steps into online browsing at that point, you know, where you wait 5 minutes for a page to turn up.
That's right.
And you couldn't use the phone at the same time. It's a and here we are having a conversation across the Atlantic now, 27 years later.
Full video. It's very, very, very Star Trek. Like, again, they pattern a lot of stuff after Star Trek. They're all Star Trek fans. Lieutenant Uhura's brother was a part of the cult, right? Yes. The Michelle Nichols, her brother was part of the cult. It was a very futuristic facing cult. And again, you kind of have to be if you're talking to UFOs, right? If you're a UFO cult.
Yeah.
That's kind of how the way I chose the stories is because a lot of cult stories are very repetitive. Even UFO cults, they're very repetitive. So I define cults with a unique twist to their story. And this idea of, besides the fact that it ended in a suicide, which is relatively rare, that does happen, but relatively rare, this idea of them being firmly enmeshed in the technologies of the era, you know, they were pioneers on the web, on the internet. So that to me was a very unique part of it. So yeah, no, I'm with you on that. They haven't, again, they're just, and it's another one like Jonestown where there's so much information on them, like yes. very well documented by themselves even,
yeah.
that, you know, new stuff comes up all the time for the people that dig into there, or stuff you didn't know about, or that's why, you know, they can make documentaries that are just full of firsthand sources because they did it. They documented themselves.
Well, especially because Applewhite was an arch publicist. He loved himself.
Yeah.
Even more than his disciples did, I suspect. yeah. But this is what we, you know, some of the things we've touched on here. You had a partnership. I'm trying to think. Did they call themselves Tea and Dough or Dot and Tea?
Yeah, they had a few cutesy nicknames for themselves. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But Applewhite was clearly one of those people. He was desperately trying to create some kind of following because he'd bounced around for like 20, 30. He was another one. He came out of California at the end of the 60s.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. New age. And he was checking, you know, he was into crystals and meditation and all that. And he kind of started drifting around and he formed one organ. You can see a pattern that he was basically just building to a point where he had enough people who believed what mm-hmm. they were saying. But as I was saying about Tony Alamo and that strange cult, once she died, it just went. And that was it. But it's really interesting as well, because the other aspect I think about Heaven's Gate, which is interesting, is that the fact it's so tied in with Hal Bopp coming.
Yeah,
and so
that's right.
I mean, I don't know. A few months ago, I re-listened to a lot of Art Bell shows from the 90s. And there was a whole tranche of them that came up sort of just prior to Heaven's Gate, where you had people going on his show saying that they could see a UFO in the tail. The comic
that's right,
tale.
That's right.
And this is, of course, linked to Heaven's Gate, because this was the whole reason. Because the reason they were going to, well, they didn't commit mass suicide. They were exiting their human forms mm-hmm. to transcend into space and be taken away in the UFO to a better world. That was the end game. Yep. And so a bit like Jonestown, where everybody says, oh, well, it was a mass suicide. Well, no, a lot of them were murdered. This, for them, it wasn't a mass suicide. They were simply leaving their human shell.
Yep, that's right. And that's why it was very much a gentle end. Like, again, the photos of photo and video of Jonestown is chaotic. It's carpet of bodies. It's trash everywhere. The footage of Heaven's Gate aftermath is just people, you know, with their shoes beside their beds, nicely laid out, covered with blankets. It was, they almost like, basically they self-fulfilled their prophecy, right? It's what they did. They didn't have the next morning after where they're like, why didn't the UFO and the comet pick us up? Mm-hmm. They didn't have that opportunity because they just kind of self-fulfilled their own prophecy. But yeah, that, and again, we want to say how strange it is to say, oh, I see a UFO in the tail. But again, from time immemorial, from the dawn of the human race, we've been seeing omens and everything in the sky, right? Comets have always been bringing something, news, death, gods, whatever. So what they did, again, sounds weird, but it's very human to look at astral phenomenon as being important or, you know, some kind of message. So again, it's really, really easy to call them strange. But then you have to call all of humanity strange, which is valid, right? But it's just for them, I don't know. And then, again, we always credit people for having strong beliefs that they stick to, which is really what Heaven's Gate did, strong beliefs that they stuck to. And it's a tragedy, it's still a tragedy, but we'll call that a tragedy. But if somebody does it in another realm, it's a positive. So again, it's all just human mess. You can really, again, this is a very big departure for me because I'm usually doing, you know, cursed objects and cryptids and strange stuff that are less weighty, you know, less depressing at the very end of it, where you're just like, okay, people believe in Bigfoot. Great. I actually love that they believe in Bigfoot. It means they have wonder. They want the world to not be kind of trampled on and they want there to be mysteries and stuff still to be revealed on this planet. At the end of cults, you're just like, man, we are a mess. We're just a mess. I can't believe we're still surviving. You know, fortunately, we're all survival machines, most of us. But you just come away with a different feeling. Ideally, I want somebody to walk away with this book not thinking, man, cults are weird and people in cults are weird. I want them depressed about their own existence. This is what I want them to walk away with. This is all of us. Like, these cults are us. They're not. Yes. Others, they are us, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And which is depressing.
Well, sadly, it is. I suppose one of the things, like we were saying about Jonestown, the flavor aid Kool-Aid thing, I think one of the strange aspects of, as if there couldn't be anything as strange as Heaven's Gate, is the fact that those photos of everybody laid on their beds in those special blankets with those special, like, little things on there where their heads were, like a little piece of material. And you could see the trainers popping out at the end of the bed or by the thing. Nike cancelled that range of trainers over this.
They
pulled them all.
That's another good point. Fred, that part of that marketing, like, you can still buy them. You go on eBay today, somebody has them, and they're trying to sell them. But Nike's like, nope, no more. That is a tainted brand, right? We can't use that anymore. But it probably would have been fine. I mean, they don't look. I mean, if you look at the shoes, they're very just. They look like Nikes. They're not very unique Nikes. They're just Nikes. But you're right. They did cancel that line because every single shot of dead bodies and comets and UFOs, the next shot was Nike, a set of Nike shoes, like at the end of a bed, right? Every single time that was part of the montage. So they had to like separate that from the brand.
Yeah. But it shows he was a clever businessman because he got them all for like a knockdown price because they were surplus stock.
That's right. That's right. So, yeah.
Hey guys, I've got you all new trainers.
Yeah. He wasn't trying to be stylish. He just like, again, they Heaven's Gate, they had, if you look at their clothes and their hairstyles and there was stuff going on for sure. There's like, you can dive in. That's a whole topic by itself.
Yeah.
But yeah. He was able to get them en masse and put everybody together. And you know, that's our image. Our image isn't, again, our image is of those Nikes is usually what you think of when you think of the Heaven's Gate aftermath.
Yeah. I mean, and that's not even going into flying some of the males to Mexico for operations to have their genitals removed.
Yeah, no, Applewhite had massive body problems like his entire life. This kind of expressed itself that way. And he got other people to share in that, you know, dysmorphia or whatever it was.
Yeah.
To like get rid of gender out of his, again, because they it kind of goes back to them being their bodies just being shells.
Yes.
You know, temporary shells. And they wanted to kind of like make them as generic as possible. That's why the food, the clothes, the hairstyles, and like, you know, people, you mutilating their genitals and like, or not all of them did it, but some did it.
Yeah.
But again, it doesn't stem from, it really stems from Applewhite's own troubles with that from, you know, early on. In fact, I think this whole cult started, he was in an asylum or retreat place because of his issues, and he met his partner and they went on a road trip and hatched out Heaven's Gate, basically.
I suppose one of the aspects that may surprise some people about the book, Jay, and this is one of those things I think, once again, has become a cliche, is this perception of satanic cults running around everywhere, right?
Right.
When you talk to people, I mean, this is one of the things, I remember talking to some friends a couple of years ago when the last series of Stranger Things came out, and we were talking about that, and my mate said, oh, I can't believe it, that anything like that went on in the 80s. I said, I can categorically tell you, mate, it went mad in the late 80s, early 90s, of satanic cults running around everywhere, corrupting kids. You know, we had all this, you know, play metal records backwards. You get messages from the devil. And
yes, I was a Christian at that time. I was a kid, but I was a Christian at that time, a fundamentalist Christian. And we were, again, we were throwing out our Smurf glasses. We had like glasses from Burger King with Smurfs on them because the Smurfs were satanic. And again, we were preaching like, don't listen to rock music because there's demonic messages in there. We'd have speakers come in and play them backwards and stuff like that. We were looking for the devil everywhere, literally everywhere. And it wasn't just Christians. It was like, for some reason, everybody. And this happened in multiple countries. It was just like, it was just this weird phenomenon where suddenly we were terrified by, again, in some ways, it's almost quaint, right? Because these days, conspiracy theories are chewed up and spit out and are actually dangerous these days because they're just. But back then, you're like, it was one of the original conspiracy theories of modern times. And, you know, it's just weird that we just saw the devil everywhere. And I guess, and again, if you look into the literature, you can trace it to like, you know, certain testimonies from children, whatever. But, what they call it, satanic panic. It was literally a panic, you know?
Yeah. I mean, everything fell under Dungeons and Dragons, music, clothing, yes. MTV.
Oh.
I mean, it even happened over here. There was a very famous case in Scotland, Jay, where a girl made allegations and it ended up with 31 families having their children take off them. Social services got involved, everything. And then eventually, after about 3 years, she said, oh, yeah, I just made it up for attention.
Yeah, which is, again, sounds bizarre, but it's very human. I mean, the Salem witch trial started that way as a bunch of kids, you know, just seeing devils everywhere, which they weren't seeing, and just couldn't stop themselves from saying it and from acting it out and stuff. So again, not unique, very, and not very, I want to keep saying very weird, but it's not very weird. It is kind of how we roll as a race.
Well, exactly. You would look at Salem and say, oh, well, you know, it's 350 years ago, Jay. They weren't very educated. They were, you know, they were just stupid. And then you see it happening 300 years later and you're like, hang on.
Yep.
Well, surely this isn't down to stupidity, because you can't tell me that people in the 1980s are less educated than people in the 1690s in Massachusetts.
We just have cooler technology. It's the only difference. Otherwise, we're the same.
And plus, people these, you know, since the sort of 80s, you know, like we were talking about Applewhite, one of his things was he used public service broadcasting to promote himself a lot. He did, you know, you can look on the internet, find those really creepy videos of him smiling.
He was actively evangelizing, that's right.
Yeah, but he was using PBS, which is like your local cable network. So he had access to things. Once again, very forward thinking, because not many people would think to do that kind of thing. But he was so convinced and determined to get his message out, to get more people with him, that he accessed things that I think other cult leaders up to that point hadn't even considered. They just looked at who's in the room with me, whereas he was thinking, who can't I get to yet?
Yeah, and I love this topic too, because right now, again, the way the defense against erroneous doctrine is knowledge, right? It's what it always is. The knowledge is always the fix for everything.
Yeah.
And we live in a society where we are two clicks away from every piece of knowledge on the entire planet, all on the internet. So you think these days we would be a much more evolved, much more knowledgeable society. But it turns out the internet has actually made us worse. It's just full of, like, we have so much information, we don't know how to parse what's true, what's not true. Everybody can find proof of every idea on the planet. So the internet is not making us more intelligent. It's actually exacerbating the very human thing of cognitive dissonance and only seeing the information you want to see, and only, you know, making small groups again, making small niche groups, that, you know, again, the internet should be this great connector. It's really not, somehow it's not. So again, because human beings, we just, our tendencies are what actually kind of rule, at any point in time in history.
Mm. Were you surprised that there weren't an official satanic cult? Because you have had a few over the years that have sort of played around with the occult. Crowley is a prime example of that, with his Golden Dawn organization and some of the other offshoots that he had, which were essentially just covers for him to have as much sex and drugs as possible whilst pretending he was a reincarnated Egyptian pharaoh during one of his many different turns and living by the banks of Loch Ness in Bolskin House. And, you know, one of my favorite Crowley stories is when he had an argument with W.B. Yeats, the poet and author here.
Yeah.
And he got so annoyed with him, he kicked him up the arse down the stairs and said, get out, you weirdo.
The Golden Dawn, right? That's when they kicked him out of that. Yes, right. That's right.
You're too weird for us. Get out.
Yeah, again, So most modern all satanic organizations that call themselves satanic, you use Satan as an icon. They don't believe in a literal Satan. They just like the idea of somebody who stands up to authority. In this case, God, right? Because the thing is, I've seen quotes from like satanic priests that say, if you believe in Satan, that's just as crazy as believing in God, right? So actual Satan worship doesn't really happen. It's just not. You'd have to be super immersed in, again, because Satan is an invented construct, right? I'm actually doing a little bit of work around Satan right now, where the origin of Satan is kind of pop culture. It's kind of like Santa Claus was invented by Coca-Cola, more or less, you know? Satan was same thing, right? Barely mentioned in the New Testament, not actually mentioned at all as Satan, you know, because it was written by Jewish people, and the Jewish people don't believe in Satan, you know? And then somehow Christianity found a bad guy to fight the God, and then, like, we turned him into a horned and hoofed thing that's actually a monster that does evil practices with other monsters. And like, it's just this story that has really elongated. So there's no actual like meat for somebody to actually want to worship Satan and do real occult. Like you said, the classic occult stuff is more either in Crowley's case, who's unique in the occult.
Yes.
He just wanted to like have sex and do whatever he wanted to do, basically do what thou wilt, right?
Yes.
To today's occult groups, I have a few friends who are in occult groups. it's mostly a self, they're mostly self-empowerment groups. They're just self-empowerment groups. They're just like a way for them to like join together, have some rituals, right? Because rituals are kind of appealing. It doesn't matter. You don't have to actually believe that they have magical effects, but rituals are very human. And that's it. That's all it is. It's a self-empowerment group. And so there's just no real satanic cults where, you know, they're hoping to bring Satan into the world and those kinds of things. They're really, and if they are, they're very isolated and not, they have no impact on culture. They're not like, whatever, propelling Led Zeppelin and the Smurfs at all.
Well, exactly. I think probably the best example of people misunderstanding is probably the Church of Satan, Antonio Levay's organization. Because if you actually get past what they're called and you listen to him, he's clearly, once again, he's one of these people that came out of the counterculture era of the 60s.
Yeah.
And he just rallied against the establishment, be it religion or government. He just wanted to fight back against the rules. And therefore, when you look at them and what LaVey says about a lot of things, he's not actually saying anything terrible.
No.
But because, and he's obviously, once again, he's another arch promoter. Because he knows exactly the connotations of calling his organization that, because he knows it's going to send the willies up people.
And he loves the theater, right? That's why the big robes, the bald head, like he loves the theater of it. And again, when people talk about satanic cults to me, I said, the only people that believe in Satan are Christians. Like Christian religions believe in Satan, pretty much that's it. So that's why they're looking for there to be, they believe there should be satanic cults out there, because they believe Satan to be an actual, real figure, you know, that actually influences the world and actually has is evil and is trying to get evil stuff in the world. So they're the only ones actually believe in Satan. They're actually Satanists. Christians are actually Satanists. Mm. They believe in Satan, right? Mm. So that's kind of the irony there, and why there's no real satanic group that is worshiping Satan as a deity.
Yeah. And it struck me actually recently, I was watching a series called Crimes of the Paranormal, which is on Disney through Hulu over here, Jack. And one of those particular episodes covers a murder of a young woman in the 1970s who was attached to a church group, which ended up being prescribed as she was sacrificed by a satanic cult in the local area because an officer said, oh, and it's when you look at the evidence and you look at what was said and what was spoken about at the time, it leaves you with one very dark. Well, it certainly did. It led me to a very dark conclusion, which I think a lot of people agree with. Basically, a police officer said to the press that her body was sort of laid out in display and there was all sort of satanic emblems and symbols laid around her and all that. And they talked about this for about 20 minutes in the program. They were telling her about it. And then they showed the actual photo, obviously blurring her out.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing there. And so you think, hang on a minute. Well, if there's nothing there, that's the crime scene photo. Why hasn't a police officer gone to the press and told him this?
Yeah.
And then it ended up that the person that ran this particular church was, he gave me Jim Jones vibes, I have to say. Yeah. And he was very angry about this particular attractive young woman who apparently was not being Christian enough. And she dated his son and then stopped dating him. And you begin to think, would this be the first religious leader that's taken a shine to a member of his congregation who rebuffs him and he murders her? And then we start this whole, because at the end of the day, you can't tell me because he was very clearly a very influential man at that time. Mm-hmm. It's like nearly 50 years ago, Jay. They always say the state and the church should never mix. But when you have these small towns where the sheriff and the local pastor are probably best buddies.
Yeah.
There's no way you can untangle that. And they will cover each other's asses. And so by the end of the episode, I came to the conclusion that somebody in that church knows who murdered her. And it by God, it's nothing to do with Satanists.
Yeah, and classically, we've always scapegoated Satan, right? He's always been the scapegoat. The devil made me do it. Like, right? That's like he's just a great way to say, no, something actually evil, and no, you're the evil, right? You're the evil. Like, it's one, again, it's a very human thing. That program sounds like an X-Files episode for sure. Yeah.
Well,
that's it. The devil's just like a scapegoat at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. But it shows you that these kind of ideas and scapegoats have always been there. And as you said, a lot of the organized religions do say weird things. We've just got used to what they say.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we come across other organizations that aren't saying things that radically different, they're just using, say, UFOs,
mm-hmm.
quite possible in believing, Jay, that there's somewhere in Oregon or Washington State where there's probably a Bigfoot cult somewhere, and we've just not heard about them yet because nothing's gone wrong.
That'd be super interesting. If it's not one, we should start one, because I don't want that to exist, I think.
Well, I'm not living in the woods, I'm sorry. But it shows you, and like we were saying about, sometimes you can watch these things collapse or come to the fore in real time. And we both mentioned Waco and Heaven's Gate. Certainly for older listeners, they will probably remember when Jonestown happened. For a lot of people in the last 10 years, Nexon is the big one.
Yeah.
I think because you've got, it's a cult that has imploded in real time in multi-streaming channel news. Mm-hmm. With documentaries falling at the drop of a hat, with whistleblowers, with the fact that people now have the internet, they can go online, they can talk about what happened to them, they can talk about what's going on. They've got more avenues to be listened to than 40, 50 years ago. Somebody's in a cult and they get out, who are they going to speak to? Who's going to believe them often?
Yeah.
And so when this all comes falling down, this is one of those where, as we've said, You take a sharp intake of breath, because at first you think, well, what on earth were they thinking? And then you think, well, we know how people are. Everybody wants to fit in. Everybody wants to belong. And if you're in such an organization where you've got high profile celebrities, famous people, billionaires, mm-hmm. heirs to massive fortunes, the son of the former Mexican president being involved, there's a lot of money here as well. Mm-hmm. What separates them is the fact that they're not a quasi-religious organization. These are a self-help group who mm-hmm. prescribed the fact that their leader was the most intelligent, sexiest man alive who could change your life just by making you think better.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you start to look at some of the things that he said, I mean, one of my favorite quotes is one of the whistleblowers said, well, he kept telling us that his sperm was supernatural.
Yeah.
And I thought, how could you sit there and listen to a man tell you that with a straight face? But then you think, you've been totally indoctrined. And then when you listen to all the recordings of him talking to people and basically breaking people down, and he's clearly a complete and utter psychopath dressed up as a metaphysical guru.
Yep. And I always say, again, that is such a, again, you hear somebody say that his sperm is supernatural, that you'd see blue or something. How could you believe that? I'm like, well, just go sit in your local church and listen to them talk about virgin births and all kinds of weirdness. It's not very unbelievable. Again, our belief is elastic. It's not like he just came to a stranger, put that fact down about his issue, and the stranger believed it. It's a process. Belief is a process, you know? And next thing is fascinating, because like you said, it's not religious. So again, cults have nothing to do with, cults are kind of, even though I define them as failing religions, you don't have to have, you know, Christian or Buddhist tenets in there or religious tenets. It can just be self-help. There are diet cults built around, you know, what you eat. So it's just a group coming together and then the leader getting too much power. And again, Nexium is a great example, because all the classic hallmarks, all the red flags that you don't see, nobody ever sees red flags until afterwards, right? In relationships, in organizations, in anything, all the classic red flags were there. It's a leader who is held to a different standard than his following. His personal mores, like him, you know, chasing every woman in the organization. It was the fact they were very secretive about their dogma, right? In this case, it's not dogma. It wasn't religious dogma. It was literally a self-help program.
Yeah.
That he tried to get patented. He tried to get his program patented even. And at the end of the day, though, in the objective light of hindsight, he was like, oh, this guy was just he was a professional pyramid scheme maker. That's what he was. Mm-hmm. That, of course, once he had all the power, it became sex slaves. And that's another reason why it caught everybody's attention, because it had salacious details, right? Mm. The branding and all those things that he would do to the women.
Horrific.
But again, those women joined those groups because he made subgroups. He made like women empowerment groups. Why would you not join a woman empowerment group as a woman? Of course, why wouldn't you? That's a great thing to join. Mm. But it was just a shell that actually did other things that he used to like do other things. So again, it's salacious. There were stars in there, important people that would join. I think even Branson was supposed to, even though he denies it, I think, once it came out, he attended one of their seminars.
The Dalai Lama.
Yeah, the Dalai Lama. So, like, it's, again, it's watching the implosion was fascinating. Because again, it's fun to pick it apart, but again, but it just proves again how elastic our belief is, how much we want a structure, how much we want a group, how much we want a group that says something different than everybody else, right? We want to be the ones with the truth. Every religion does. We're the ones with the ultimate truth. Everybody else is wrong. That's a very human. We need that. If we don't want to be generic, like we just have this, like, we just want to be the ones that are in the know and special. We want to be special, right? Every human being wants to be special when the truth is very few of us are, and you can make a case that none of us are. So that's, it's all there. It's all in Nexium. It's all in this group that was basically just, for all intents and purposes, teaching corporate people how to be better, better leaders, better, better managers, better everything, right? And that turned into a cult.
I think it struck me as well, Jay, because I've met someone, I was friends with someone for quite a long time, who really does remind me of Keith Raniere. In his behavior, the way he carries himself, he's the cleverest person in the room. He knows more than you do. He's always right. And you, when you look back, you see these things, and you've let it slide at the time, or you overlook it. Like you were saying, there's people waving red flags, but we're all colorblind until the shit hits the fan.
The joke is you can't see red flags when you're wearing rosy colored glasses, you know.
And so, but he, you just look at that, you know, I mean, one, like we're saying about the powers of his semen, I remember in the court one of the witnesses said that he claimed that his intelligence was so great he would set off airport scanners. Because it was that powerful.
He was supposed to be the world record holder for IQ. The world record holder, right?
Yeah, with three
smartest
degrees.
Smartest guy on the planet.
Yeah, 3 degrees he had.
Yeah.
Which, to be fair, he wasn't a stupid man.
Right.
But he wasn't as clever as either he liked to think he was or how, what he liked to tell people. He claimed to be like one of the greatest judo artists on the planet,
the most ethical man ever. That was one of his titles.
Most ethical man you'll ever meet. He was an Olympic standard sprinter, but decided he didn't want to do it.
See, this is the thing. So leadership takes certain qualities, right? Charisma, drive, belief, all these things. But the thing is, leadership qualities aren't rare. There's a million leaders on the planet, right?
Yes.
The red flag comes not because he had charisma. I want a leader to have charisma. The red flag comes when he starts saying he's different than everybody else on the planet. And that's usually that's why almost every single cult leader says that they're a reincarnation of Jesus Christ, because they have to be the most unique on the planet. And that's when, you know, I'm the best at this, the best at that. Nobody's ever. That's when you start, that red flag should start flying, right? We're like, oh, why does this guy think he's unique on the planet? Mm. It's because once he gets you to believe that, he'll get you to believe, you'll believe pretty much anything he says, right? Because you see him as uniquely gifted in ways that nobody else is. So he must have some unique insight in the world, right? And also you just feel like privileged to be around that kind of power, right? That's part of it. We all feel, you know, there's not a single actor that goes to a bar will always get drinks bought for him, right? Because we just want to be around that kind of specialness. So that's what it is. And Nexium is, again, textbook. Like, if you just broke down what a cult is and what the flags are and what they do, Nexium fills every single niche.
Yeah. Like you say, do you think that they got away with it for so long because they weren't preaching a religious message?
Yeah, I think that. Also, they were very secretive about their dogma. They would not let that was one of the things they made their people that went to the seminars, like, they swear to, is don't tell anybody the steps or don't tell anybody what we do here. And they would wear sashes and they would, like, do repeat mantras and stuff like that. It wasn't pure just like PowerPoint slides with graphics on them like most business seminars. I think it's because it was just self-help is self-help. There's a million of those things. And the other thing is they wouldn't tell people what they were actually preaching. So I think it's those two things that, like, allowed them to operate for so long.
I mean, as we were saying about some of these other situations and other organizations, Jay, obviously this is still very raw for a lot of people. This is still, the ramifications of this are still rippling out there.
Yep.
I mean, one of the things that made me chuckle was that obviously he's got sentenced to 120 years in prison. So he's never getting out. Mm-hmm. But apparently one of his supporters, one of the sort of main lieutenants who didn't get a jail sentence, I think, organized dance troupes to turn up outside the prison and perform for him until the prison caught on, and then they moved him to a wing where he couldn't see it. So he then suggested that they should start seducing the prison guards so they could get him moved back so he could watch them dance for him. I mean, that, even in a cell after being sentenced, he's still able to reach out and control these people.
That's right. Because, again, that cognitive dissonance kicks in. I couldn't have been wrong for that amount of time, right?
Yes.
Or, you know, again, they find some excuse of why it was all okay or permissible or not what the, you know, the media presented it wrong, right? That's kind of thing. Or the court was, the kangaroo court, it wasn't. There's always ways for them to do that. Yeah. And it's not even unique, right? The Anthill Kids out in Canada was another cult where when he got jailed, his followers all bought apartments near the jail waiting for his signal or him to get released or anything. Like, they just were like, it was a moment. It didn't end the cult for him to go to jail.
Yeah.
It for some it did, for sure. Others were in jail too. But like, belief is almost impossible to quash. Like, really is. I mean, I don't even know how it happens, right? I mean, it happened to me somehow, but I don't know how it happened. It was just kind of this gradual thing. Mm. And I think it's just time. Time might change belief, but if prison can't change it, then like the unveiling of very insidious things happening in the organization can't change it, right? Mm. We're a mess. Mm. All of us, this entire thing we're in.
I remember hearing one of the, because the Anthill Gang is the Anthill Kids. One of those, I think, they're really under the radar. Not many people know about them, Jay. I think,
right. And then outside one of Canada. The most vicious cults, as far as cult leaders go. Oh. That one was probably the hardest one for me to write. And it was the first one I wrote about because I wanted to test to make sure. Because, again, part of my challenge was, you know, I have a very kind of a very conversational tone in my books, very lighthearted jokes. So, and that's fine when you write about Bigfoot or the Hope Diamond.
Yeah.
When you're writing about actual abuse, it's hard to do. I still wanted that. So that was my challenge. How do I keep my tone and write about actual tragedies and traumas? And they were the worst cult I could find, I thought, as far as like the details. So I wrote about them to prove out the concept to my publisher and to myself. Mm. Because what he would do was atrocious. He did things that no other cult, that Jim Jones didn't do. And even like, you know, even, I just lost the guy's name, Manson, even Manson, the hideous things that Manson's followers did were still pretty typical violence. Mm. What he did was just off the, it's even hard to talk about it. So off the charts, disgusting, right? Yeah. And depraved.
Yeah.
So, but again, his followers, when he got jailed, they lost kids. My favorite, the most telling quote of the entire book for me, I can't remember her name, but one of his wives in that cult who had been abused, like I think she'd had one of her breasts removed, teeth removed, burned.
Yeah.
She had her arm nailed to a table until it turned purple and had to be amputated.
Yeah.
After all of that, when he was in jail, what she said was, yes, certainly when he was doing surgeries on people, he was awful, but otherwise he was a pretty good guy, which sounds like a joke. It sounds like a joke. You know, take away all of Hitler's crimes. He was a pretty good guy. But it was a firm belief because again, they couldn't rationalize what they'd been through and what they believed with what we all saw, right. As objective observers. But to me, the Anthill Kids is the most harrowing. Again, Jim Jones is awful. Manson's awful. A lot of them are awful. But for some reason, and maybe I'm wrong with this, for me personally, that one was the most harrowing one to get through.
Mm. Well, it's interesting you mentioned Manson as well, like you say, because he's probably the pop culture icon for a cult leader, I think. Mm-hmm. He's also one of those who I just found him towards the end just ridiculous because he'd become a caricature. He didn't seem like a real person, you know, with his swastika carved into his own head and just babbling crap every time he got the opportunity. Because he loved publicity. He couldn't cope without people. The worst thing you could do to Charles Manson was ignore him because that just sent him crackers. And so he would make these crazy statements and the media would, you know, take the bait every time, it would seem, Jay, and come and listen to him talk crap for hours. And he always said, oh, well, I didn't do anything, trying to sort of disassociate himself. But everything he did and everything he created and the way he manipulated these vulnerable young people to become his acolytes is a cast iron example of what a cult leader is. Yep. Because they send these people out to do whatever they want them to do. And then if the shit hits the fan once again, it's nothing to do with me. You know, they're all adults. I didn't make them do anything. I wasn't there. Well, you
were,
buddy.
That's one of the flapping red flags, is the rules of the cult don't apply to the leader, right?
Yes.
We have this fiction. We have this fiction in, you know, most societies, definitely in the States, where no one's above the law, right? Mm. Even though it is kind of a fiction, right? If you're rich, powerful, you can get around the law. But we still have that fiction. We have to have that fiction. But even then, people who are rich and powerful, they can only go so far before they aren't above the law. They can't skirt the law anymore, right? Somebody finally, you know, P. Diddy, right? Which rich and powerful was able to skirt the law forever. He was above the law until he wasn't, right? Suddenly now it all comes down on him. But in cults, they don't even have the fiction, not even the fiction that everybody is under the same law. That's the red flag, because there's no fiction there for everybody to ascribe to. It's just whatever the cult leader wants to do. If Koresh wants to have all the women and make all the men celibate, that's okay. If Manson wants to send out all these people to do violence and murder and he doesn't do any, that's okay. That's one of the major flags in my estimation, is do the rules apply to everybody? And again, in successful religions, they have that fiction, right?
Yeah.
You know, the Pope is still under the law of God. He's different from everybody else. He's a leader, but he's still under the law of God. The Southern Baptist preacher, still under the law of God, even when he isn't, right? Even when he's breaking the rules, they still have the fiction of, no, he still is in service to God. Hmm. Most the cults that don't have that have a problem, because that just opens up the avenue for abuse.
Yeah. I remember watching something last, because once again, like Jonestown, I think the Manson family case is one of those where you think you know everything about it. And I ended up watching a documentary about it last year, which was really eye-opening for me on several levels. But the thing that really struck me was that the day after Sharon Tate and her child had been murdered, Roman Polanski did an interview at the house, and it hadn't been cleaned up at all.
Really? I don't think I knew that. That's
and
wild.
There was pictures of him in the house. There's blood on the walls. There's all the messages. All the furnishings are tipped over and ripped up. And he's just wandering around in like a green velvet suit. And I'm thinking, none of it. I mean, to be fair, let's be honest, I don't think anybody knows how they would react in the aftermath of such a horrific incident occurring.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
But that just struck me as just something else that makes that whole series of events even weirder, Jay, because that on any level just doesn't seem like a normal response to what's happened. But the fact that the media were with him, talking to him, taking pictures of him in this house, in this crime scene. And that's the other thing. The police are just going, go on, mate, you get yourself in. No problems. We don't need any more evidence here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's again, like you said, we don't know how we'd react, but I always put rich, famous people in a different category. Again, we're all human, we're all a mess, but rich, famous people are in this. They act, their motivations and actions, I feel like, are just much different than the rest of ours. Yeah. Like living an entire life in the spotlight changes you into almost a different species, I think. And again, that story, the Manson story, the deeper you dig into it, it is more interesting. It's more interesting than the popular conception of it. There are just layers and layers, and it doesn't get better. The story doesn't get better, but like it gets things. At the end of the day, it's a very crass story. It's not like this big. Again, Manson wants it to be this big revolutionary story. It's not. It's very crass, very drug deals gone awry kind of story.
There's
it's one of those things where there's so much. It's another one that's very well documented, because it was LA, because it was all these things, because it was, you know, Roman Polanski's was involved, right? It's very well documented. That's another hard thing, like when I write a book about a Bigfoot, there's not a ton of documentation around each individual case, right? Each individual instance. With cults though, And those documentations are very obscure. With cults, though, it's almost impossible to write 2,000 words about the Manson case. Mm. It's just, there's just so much out there, and that was just so hard to do.
Mm. I'm trying to think. It might be. This is one of those weird things that occurs sometimes in the modern era. Peter Dinklage, the actor.
Yeah.
Mm. Obviously very famous these days after his time on Game of Thrones and the numerous films and things. He does the series on Prime. And the one I think I saw, the Manson thing, was he did a mini series called How to Be a Cult Leader, which featured him. And I think that's where the Polanski footage is.
Oh, okay.
And it was one of them where, like you've just said about the tone of how you normally write, you have to adapt and change it, because you're not talking about Bigfoot anymore. We're talking about certain situations which have very dark aspects to them a lot of the time, Jay. And whilst there was a bit of humour through it, like the story of Manson meeting Brian Wilson and then just moved into his house for a fortnight and wouldn't fuck off. Right. You know, just wouldn't leave his house.
Because he gave him a bunch of STDs, right?
Yeah.
That's another part of it. Yeah.
And also wanted, you know, he was convinced he was going to be the next Beatles. He was going to be a singer. And, you know, he was desperately trying to sort of get himself into that L.A. love scene. And all the bands like the Mamas and the Papas and the Beach Boys, he wanted to be part of that. And they wouldn't have him. High on LSD, they didn't care for his company.
Yep.
And so you find these little things about these characters, and it really shows them that one way or another they're gonna get what they want. Sometimes they just take a little bit longer to get to that throne that they crave.
It is, and you brought this up a few times. The 60s and 70s were kind of a golden era for cults, because counterculture was rejecting culture, right? Counterculture is saying we don't want this anymore, and that left a void. Like, if we don't want this, what do we want? And people like Manson and other gurus would pop up and say, well, I have something for you then. How about this? So that was a very vulnerable time for people when they needed something to join, because they had rejected what everybody else had been joining for, you know, decades, right? Mm. So that is another way to humanize cults, is to say, no, people were just looking for the next culture, right? Which is why, you know, the Beatles go to India, right? And look for gurus and stuff. They're looking for something to replace the thing they lost, because the thing they lost was necessary, right? Mm. You need that kind of, like, you need something to join. You just need something to join. And if it's society or not, you know, you need it.
Well, it is. I mean, like you say, it was clearly a hotbed. I mean, one of my favorite music stories is about Fleetwood Mac. And I forgot the chap's name. I think he was called Jeremy. He's one of the original members. And they were on tour. And obviously, Peter Green had his breakdown. And so they were just stumbling around desperately trying to hold the band together. And he went to a bookstore in L.A., I think it was, and he got talking to two women, and then he just went, right, I'm off. And he ran off and joined this, like, religious cult, and that was it. He left Fleetwood Mac and joined a cult he met in a bookshop.
And he wrote a bunch of I can't remember the name of the cult, escapes, because a lot of cults have generic Christian-sounding names. He actually wrote a lot of their hymns.
Yeah. So, well, Peter Green did the same.
He'd write them. Yeah.
Peter Green did the same. He'd moved in with a cult in Germany. But this is the thing people always say about Peter Green. Oh, well, he went mad through acid, and nobody could help. When this guy ran off with the cult that he met in a bookshop, Mick Fleetwood rang Peter Green, because he's living in this convent in Germany somewhere, and said, oh, Jeremy's run off, can you help us? So he flew to Germany to play with the band for the rest of the tour, and then he went back to this cult in Germany that he joined, which is one of the, like, what? what is going on here?
Even rock stars aren't immune, you know? Yeah.
And that's before that, you know, Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks went and Fleetwood Mac sort of ingested half of Columbia for the rest of the 70s. You know, I mean, how strange can that band be in one decade?
Yeah, yeah. No, it again, everybody's looking for the thing, right? Yes. And that's why cults exist.
Absolutely.
Because it can provide the thing.
Yeah. I suppose, wrapping up, Jay, how did you feel at the end of the book compared to the beginning? We all have preconceived ideas. We all have cognitive dissonance, you could say, in regards to the aspects of some of these organizations. Did you go into this with a sort of positive outlook and come to the end and look back at it and think, this just seems to be like a constant repeating hell, that it doesn't matter what we do, what knowledge is out there, what level of intelligence, what support people have, these organizations, these collaborations will always be there looking for vulnerable people, be it in America, Canada, Britain, Europe, Africa, whatever. They're out there. They're out there right now. There's probably something happening somewhere around this world that none of us are aware of until, as we've mentioned several times, things go horribly wrong.
Right. Yeah. So I went in really cynical. I'm generally a cynical person about everything on the planet. I'm just cynical. And so I went in with the cynicism, right? At the end of it, the cynicism was pretty validated, obviously. Like, again, I keep saying this, we're just a mess. Humanity's just a mess. But what I did change, where I grew and learned, is, again, that empathy. Like, these people are us, right? Mm. We are all vulnerable. We are, again, at our lowest state, whether that's existentially, physically, socially, we would all, you know, make the same decisions. So I think I came into it cynical, still cynical, but that empathy grew a little bit. I don't, you know, when I hear, again, same as somebody who believes in Bigfoot, I have that empathy for them. Like, okay, they want this to exist because of the wonder. Nobody wants a world we've already explored to death. Same with cults. These are just people longing for something. And that, you know, breaks my heart. I see myself in it. All those things. So it might have made me, even though I stayed cynical, it might have made me a little bit more human, I think, which is, I guess, the goal is to be as human as possible.
I think the thing I took from reading the book, Jake, was it made me appreciate the members more than the leaders.
Yeah.
And understand their vulnerability a lot more, which is not what I expected, I have to say. You usually go into this sort of fairly cynical, as you refer to. We all have an idea about some of these organizations before we even read about them. But watching what I've watched over the last few years and my interest in this particular topic, and then reading your book, which, I, as I say, is very sympathetic to some of these unfortunate people that have found themselves getting through these hellish situations that, you know, God forbid any of us end up in something like this. It really made me view the topic in a more mature way, which is probably the best thing a reader can have when they read your book.
Yeah, I appreciate it. That makes me happy. That's literally why, you know, why we made the sections about what the people were looking for. We tried to organize cults by, they look for salvation, for protection, because so they get that makes me happy that you said that. That's exactly what I would like people to get out of this. I would like people to get out of this almost normalizing cults, like not making it this, you know, aberration of humanity. It's just part of the human puzzle. And that's what I would like people to walk out of it with.
Yeah. I think we need to demystify them.
Yeah, I agree. Totally agree.
You know, at the end of the day, they're all just normal people. Just some of them are cleverer at being able to manipulate people than most of us are, I think.
That's right. And we've all been manipulated by somebody in our life. So
we've all been there. We've all had situations in his life when afterwards, when the dust settles, we've gone, what was I thinking?
Yes. We've all asked that. That's a good question. That we've all asked ourselves that same question. What was I thinking? Yep. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Well, Jake, listen, it's been wonderful chatting to you. I could carry on for probably another 3 hours because there's so many unusual organizations inside the pages of your latest tome. Where can everybody get a copy of this book and also your previous works and keep up to date with your online, my friend?
Sure. It's available everywhere, wherever you buy books, indie bookstores, chains, Amazon. It's in audiobook. It's audio format and ebook and hardback. If you want a nice central location, my website, oddthingsiveseen.com, has all my writings, all my books. It'll send you wherever you need to go to get free stuff or not free stuff. But that's it, oddthingsiveseen.com. Otherwise, just, you know, anywhere you buy books.
And lastly, before I let you leave, I always like to find out what somebody's up to. I have an inkling that your next project, you're delving into strange locations.
Yes.
Such as probably the most famous weird location is allegedly the Bermuda Triangle.
Yes.
But I love strange places like the Bridgewater Triangle. I mean, there's several. I mean, I like the Bridgewater Triangle primarily because there doesn't seem to be nothing that's not happening there.
I just drove around that a few months ago. I went to all the places I could find in there. But yeah, there's 1,000 stories in that triangle. Yeah.
Do you see any pugwudgies while you were up there?
I did not see any pugwudgies. Yeah. But I didn't go to the edge of the cliff in Freetown Forest. That's probably where I'd find them the most. A little bit scary to go to the edge of that quarry cliff.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's exactly it. My next book, which, you know, won't come out till for another year, I'm going to, and mostly, not every, I'm not going to every site, but I'm going to a lot of unusual places, researching a lot. The Bermuda Triangle story, again, that's the classic. We've been reading about that since we were kids, right? And I finally got the chance to dig into, like, what the story is and how it got there. And to me, just to give you a tiny preview, the most interesting story is how it became the Bermuda Triangle, how it became the poster thing for the paranormal is more fascinating than what actually happens in the triangle, honestly. So those are the stories I'm looking at right now.
Yeah. Does it involve Charles Berlitz by any chance?
I don't think so, but it involves a bunch of writers for sure.
Yeah, he did a lot to sort of promote that. Is there any location then that you've been surprised that there's so much lore and strangeness that you perhaps thought, oh, well, this is obviously the Bermuda Triangle. The most famous thing is, well, ships disappear and planes disappear.
That's the entire story of the Bermuda Triangle.
But when you start digging into it, you've got people seeing strange lights in the sky. You've got people seeing strange lights in the sea. You've got people seeing ghosts walking on the surface mm-hmm. of the sea. There's a lot more to it. There's sea monsters. There's all kinds of stuff.
That's right. And that's kind of the motivation for the book, is finding those spots where everything happens, yeah. right? That those are the ones that are the most cherry for me, the ones that I could, that fulfill the spirit of the book the most. Like the Bridgewater Triangle you just mentioned, serial killers and cryptids and UFOs and other less categorizable things all happening together. So that's kind of the places I'm looking at. Not every place has that, but if there's only one story, it's not, it doesn't belong in the book. It has to have lots of crossover stories that just make that spot on the planet, for whatever reason, infamous or famous, versus whatever, the entire acreage of the planet, right?
Yeah. Have you found a new favorite weird location then during this?
I'll tell you one, but it's not supernatural. It's the Salton Sea in California, which I'm about to go visit in a couple of weeks.
Yes.
It's, the story isn't about, there's no ghosts, there's no UFOs, but it is one of the most fascinating stories I've ever read. Mm. How it went from like a resort destination for the likes of Bing Crosby and the Marx Brothers to being an absolute apocalyptic wasteland straight out of Mad Max. It was so fascinating. When I finished the chapter, I was like, it was like thousands of words over without mentioning UFOs or ghosts. One time I had 1,000 stories in this place, which is unique for me. Usually every other word I use is ghost, UFO, or Bigfoot.
Yeah.
The Salton Sea in California is a great story.
Yeah. You've got to be careful when you mention Bing Crosby. I have to say, recently I fell down a Bing Crosby rabbit hole. And you will be amazed. I'm not going to go on and on about it. But when you look past him as the singer and the actor, and you look at what he was doing off screen, it's incredible what that man did. It's barmy. I didn't know half of it.
Again, rich and famous in the spotlight forever. Those are different people.
Yeah. You know, the man that essentially helped create VHS, basically.
Yes, yes. No, I'm a big Bing fan in general. I've been to like both of his houses, and like I've been to a museum dedicated to him.
Yeah.
My favorite thing about him is the way he's really immortal these days is not really any of his movies work or music work. It's because of his Christmas carols and his Sleepy Headless Horseman song.
Yes.
Like the holidays are keeping Bing Crosby alive, not Bing Crosby's work. Yeah. So I just love that phenomenon.
Yeah. Last ever live performance was in this country.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He sang here on the Sunday, and then flew to Spain to play golf where he died.
Have you guys put like a blue plaque on the spot?
It was at the BBC, I think. He did a interview and sort of live performance for the BBC, and he did a few songs and a concert for them, and then flew out to Spain to play some golf, and obviously died after he'd finished his round, sadly.
Died doing what he loved, for sure.
Oh, he certainly did love his golf. Well, Jay, it's been an absolute pleasure to catch up with you again. I hope it isn't as long next time. In fact, I know it won't be. And I just want to say,
cryptids.
Yes, I say thank you again. Thank you for another brilliant book. I'm really excited about the next one. And I just wish you the very best. And I wish you and yours a wonderful Christmas and all the best for the new year, my friend.
You as well. Thanks again for the invite. This was a blast, man.